In Darfur, warnings of an unfolding humanitarian disaster. Across Sudan, more than 2 million people have now been displaced by the fighting.
There's a million little stories here from people, some missing family members, some injured, some ill now, some with nothing but the clothes on their back and not even shoes.
Also ahead, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers has died. Daniel Ellsberg said when he got his hands on the documents a half century ago, he had to sound the alarm.
I had never read anything authoritative that was that prescient, you know, and that pessimistic of what we were going to do.
I'm Carol Hills, plus shouting into the wind for science.
Waffles are better than pancakes.
It's not as futile as you might think. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We begin our coverage today focused on Sudan. The conflict there is entering its third month. Hundreds of people have died. Some 2.5 million are displaced, searching for safety. In a video posted to Twitter, you can see a huge line of people walking across the red earth scrubland of Sudan. It's hard to make out where the line of people begins or ends. Hundreds, possibly thousands of people walking toward a new life. One snapshot of the new reality for millions in Sudan. The fighting has devastated parts of Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The violence is also getting worse in the region of Darfur. That area has already experienced what's called the first genocide of the 21st century. As The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi reports, there are real fears it's happening again.
The phone networks and internet service have been mostly down throughout this conflict, so it's been hard to reach people in Sudan. Yet, on a scratchy line, the governor of West Darfur, Khamis Abakar, managed to speak with an Arab TV channel to talk about what is happening in that part of the country. He said West Darfur state has been ravaged by the rapid support forces and the Arab militias they're working alongside. The RSF arose from the Janjaweed, or Arab militias in Darfur. They were complicit in a genocide against ethnic African tribes there in the 2000s. Now they're battling the Sudanese military for power over the country. All of the health facilities are completely destroyed, said Abakar. He said people are getting injured on a daily basis, but they have nowhere to go. He also said doctors were being targeted and even kidnapped. He called on the international community to intervene to rescue the people of his state. Shortly after Governor Abakar gave this interview, he was abducted and killed. A video circulating online appears to show Abakar in the custody of a group of armed men. The RSF says they are not to blame for this death, but the Sudan Conflict Observatory, an independent monitoring platform supported by the U.S. State Department, said the governor's death was an extrajudicial killing, quote, highly likely perpetrated by the RSF. The paramilitary force has been behind many of the recent atrocities in Darfur, says Mohammed Hassan. He's with the Darfur Network for Human Rights, which has been recording incidences of violence.
We record the violation of the killing and violation of the attacks, property of civilian, houses are looted. And also we are recorded about the wounded and also recorded about the sexual violence.
He adds that public buildings and infrastructure have also been attacked.
University, Minister of Education, Minister of the Health. So this all destroyed, and also resource of water, you know, all destroyed.
He also accused the RSF of targeting non-Arab tribes in Darfur. Members of the Darfuri diaspora are watching events closely, like Osama Mahmoud of the Darfur Union UK, an advocacy organization. He's been talking with his family and friends stuck in Darfur. I ask him what their biggest needs are.
These people are required of humanitarian aid. Some of these people are required of medical supplies and medical aid as well. So this is the things that people are asking. Safer passages, safer space, medical supplies, and also food supplies.
But the ongoing violence has made it difficult to deliver humanitarian aid throughout Sudan and especially in Darfur. Doctors Without Borders has said the situation there is unbearable. For The World, I'm Halima Gakandi in Nairobi.
For more on the situation across Sudan, we turn now to William Carter. He's the Sudan director with the Norwegian Refugee Council, and he joins us from Eastern Sudan. I asked him what options people have to escape the fighting.
It's a devastating scene, really, in Khartoum and other parts, and many people desperate to leave. They have to negotiate armed checkpoints, of course, crossfire, and in some cases, targeted attacks. In every direction, it's pretty tough going, and not to mention in Khartoum, where a whole new level of violence is underplaying. But many people, as you say, 2.5 million displaced already, and that figure is likely an underestimate at the moment. We just can't see all of what's happening across Darfur, and we don't have the staff all over the country yet to properly count, register, assist everyone. So people are fleeing.
And where are they fleeing to? Safer parts of Sudan or out of the country entirely?
The majority are fleeing within Sudan to slightly safer parts, or at least to escape where the peak of the violence is happening. And then a number have left the country, maybe 500,000 have already tried to cross borders, and many are waiting to do so. You know, Khartoum was a city of 6 or 7 million people. Many of those have fled eastwards. People in Darfur fleeing westwards, particularly into Chad. They've had very traumatic situations, depressing situations. They've got very little left on to survive. So there's a million little stories here from people, some missing family members, some injured, some ill now, some with nothing but the clothes on their back and not even shoes, millions of them.
Tell me a few stories about the people you're meeting. Who are they?
We've got all walks of life, as you'd expect from a city. You know, yesterday I'd met people who had been widowed in the last couple of weeks. They have very little. They only have what was in their handbag and had to come to a really unknown place. We've had people who haven't heard from the rest of their family, stuck in Darfur because communications have been down for the last month, and they get, you know, very anxious stories and news from that region. Met children. Some still have shrapnel inside their abdomens. Met other injured people who have had to flee. They feel a bit safer where they are.
And when you meet people like that, when you hear of kids who still have shrapnel in them, are they able to get assistance, medical assistance, or is the emphasis now on just getting them out of danger?
Many of the people that I've met have left the battle zone itself and are in a slightly safer part of the country where I've been, where hundreds of thousands of people have come to. They're really desperate for assistance, for services, for some way to survive and ideally connect with family that they haven't been in contact with.
William, as this refugee crisis spirals, there are attempts at ceasefires and peace talks. Are those efforts helping the humanitarian crisis at all?
There's a number of efforts globally in the region. To be honest, most of them have been angled towards securing ceasefires. Only one, mostly held in one city, in the capital, in Khartoum, once. But there's been maybe 7 or 8 of them so far. So it's a very limited set of traction. It seems like both sides in this conflict are digging in for a longer war at this stage, and now what's happening in Darfur is completely taking on a even more serious dimension than what's happened in Khartoum. So if those were designed to allow assistance in, very limited assistance is getting in. We still have, you know, over 20 visas pending for the last month or so. Imports still haven't been approved by customs authorities yet. So I think there still is need to keep up diplomatic pressures to make sure that humanitarian action and assistance can reach to millions of people who desperately need it right now.
William Carter is the Norwegian Refugee Council's director for Sudan. He's been speaking to us from Eastern Sudan. William, thank you for sharing everything you're seeing, especially in a country that's harder and harder to report from. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
A delegation of African leaders arrived in Kyiv today. The diplomatic peace mission includes leaders from South Africa, Senegal, Zambia, the Comoros, and Egypt. The group met with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky today, and tomorrow they meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said they will keep an open mind with both leaders and that all viewpoints should be put on the table.
This is indeed a historic mission. in a quest for peace.
To discuss the trip and its goals, we reached out to Jude Moore, a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. Jude, throughout the war, delegations from Ukraine and Russia have toured the African continent trying to get support. Where do the various leaders on this African delegation stand in the war?
The delegation is sort of split, and functionally has to be. So on the delegation, you have some who have voted for resolutions condemning Russian action in Ukraine, and then you have others who have abstained. They're reflecting different interests and different views on the continent about the conflict. It is, however, the presence of South Africa that raises the most questions because of the accusations by Americans that South Africans transferred weapons to Russia. We've already seen the South African delegation having problems. The security team was prevented from disembarking in Poland, and they've been kept on the plane for almost 24 hours.
Well, Egypt is also implicated in those accusations as well, aren't they?
That's true. There were accusations that Egypt itself had planned to transfer weapons to the Russians. Of course, Egypt also denied those accusations. But I think you have to look at it from the perspective of Africans. The understanding is that these countries then have gained some sort of leverage with the Russians, putting the African delegation in a stronger position if they're to make any impact or headway with Russia.
Does the fact that these five African nations are coming together in a diplomatic initiative, is that kind of a new effort by Africa to be in the peacemaking game?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think first is that there has been a very concerted push by African countries for a bigger say in matters of global governance. So, for example, under Macky Sall, the current president of Senegal, the African Union asked for a permanent seat at the G20 to become a permanent member of the G20. They've also been pushing for a permanent seat for Africa on the UN Security Council. So there has been this push for Africa to have a more meaningful and substantive voice in issues of global governance, from things as diverse as the war in Ukraine to resolving climate change. So what we're seeing now is a more assertive foreign policy. That's one thing. The second thing is sort of self-interested. The continent imports about 100 million metric tons of cereal annually. Russia and Ukraine are large contributors to that. Last year, we saw an almost 30% increase in the price of fertilizer when over 50% of the continent's labor force is involved in some form of agriculture. So this move, as much as it is about a more forceful voice for Africa in international governance, is also about ensuring that grain and fertilizer remains accessible to Africans. So it's a combination of the self-interest, but also a bigger role in international diplomacy.
This delegation from Africa, they're proposing some measures to help with a peace process. What are they proposing?
Reuters has seen copies of some of the things they're proposing, but one is that Russia withdraws tactical nuclear weapons from Belarus, that Russian troops withdraw from parts of Ukraine. The plan that they're proposing sort of sees some portion of Ukrainian territory remaining with the Russians, and that is a non-starter, of course, with Ukraine, because Ukraine has already rejected any peace plan that sees it ceding territory to Russia.
Bottom line, what are the prospects that this delegation will have success?
So this is France has been at this for a while. China has been at this. The Turks have tried. The idea that the Africans are going to come in and alter the dynamics and move the dial in a much more significant way than others have done before. We have to be hopeful, but realistically, it's unclear. It is, however, possible that they might be able to get concessions on the things that are most immediately important to Africa. The continuation of the Green Deal and continued access to fertilizers. Also, they're trying to resolve how Africans pay Russia for Russian exports to the continent. But again, it's just how fraught the situation is. Even as they were arriving in Kyiv, Kyiv came under a barrage of Russian missiles. So the prospect of success seemed pretty dim.
Jude Moore is a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Anthems across the globe can be problematic. The French sing about the blood of their enemies watering their fields. Or closer to home, Whitney Houston there performing the U.S. national anthem penned by Francis Scott Key, an overt racist. Then there's Austria, A group of prominent authors sent an open letter to the government of the state of Burgenland saying their regional anthem should be thrown out. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The anthem of Burgenland was written in 1936. Burgenland is a province of Austria, and all nine provinces have anthems. The composer was a man named Peter Zauner.
Well, Peter Zauner, he joined the Nazi Party in 1938, shortly after the German invasion in Austria.
This is Ludwig Laher, a member of the Austrian Writers Association, the group behind the letter. The lyrics and melody of this anthem aren't anti-Semitic, says Laher, but that isn't the point.
Our criticism in this Burgenland case is that none of the federal states of Austria, with its history in the 20th century, should have an official state symbol. For instance, the coat of arms, flag, anthem, originated by a member of the Nazi party.
Laher says by no means is the Burgenland anthem the worst offender. This is the Salzburg anthem. The composer, Ernst Sompeck, joined the Nazi party in Austria even before the Germans took over, when it was still illegal to be a member. Laher says Sompeck played a prominent role in the Nazi regime, unlike Peter Zauner, the Burgenland composer, who was more of a functionary.
He was a radical Nazi, and this is no qualification for an Austrian anthem.
In all, Laher and his group have asked local governments in five of the nine Austrian states to change or throw out their anthems and look for new ones. So far, none have been changed. And the movement seems to have hit a nationalist nerve in Austria. The far-right Freedom Party, which is leading in national polls, is accusing the authors of trying to cancel history.
Die Landeshymne ist ein wichtiger Teil unserer Identität.
Elmar Eichbichler is a spokesperson for the Freedom Party in Carinthia, one of the states where the anthem has come under criticism. He says, our regional anthem is an important part of our identity. It helps preserve our proud national history. Andrew Barker is an emeritus professor of Austrian studies at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He says Austria has struggled to come to grips with its Nazi past.
Austria is very often in these issues a bit behind the curve.
Austria was the first country invaded by Germany, but the majority of Austrians welcomed Hitler. He was greeted in Vienna in 1938 by cheering, happy crowds.
Austria had this wonderful get-out clause that it was apparently the first victim of fascism, therefore didn't have to really confront its past in the way that Germany had.
A national reckoning has taken generations. Ludwig Laher says he started talking about the problem with his local national anthem in 1991, and it's taken 30 years for the government to acknowledge the composer's anti-Semitism.
It's a first step, and that's at least something that we've achieved over the years.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
In Ukraine, the waters from that dam burst earlier this month are receding and revealing a brutal picture. Ruined homes and destroyed farm fields. Toxic floodwaters washing over vast swaths of land. Dozens of protected areas were in the path of the floods, while others are getting less water because the Kakhovka Reservoir is drying up. One of them is Oleshka Sands National Park. It's a 62-square-mile desert in eastern Ukraine, the second largest expanse of sand in Europe. When the Kakhovka Dam burst, people with personal ties to the sands started sharing their memories of the dunes. We spoke with one man in Kyiv who's helped organize long-distance races there.
My name is Andrei Filin, and I'm a trail runner.
He, like a lot of Ukrainians, says Oleshka Sands are a special place.
If someone wanted to experience what a real desert looks like, you don't have to go to Sahara. You can go to here in Oleshka Sands. For an ordinary person, this would suffice to understand and experience the real desert.
Phelan told The World's Carolyn Beeler what the park means to him. He recounted the first time he visited the desert and went on a long run by himself.
I started 5 in the morning. It was still dark, and I covered the distance of 25 kilometers. It was very, very dark, and even though there were stars in the sky, had it not been for my headlamp, I wouldn't know where to run. At night, the sand was damp, and therefore it was rather hard. But as soon as the sun rose and started heating up the sand, although the water from the sand evaporated and the sand became very soft, so your feet would go deep into the sand and it became very difficult to run at that point. And when I was running there, it was so silent there. I've never experienced such a silence anywhere else. There was not a single soul around. That's exactly why I wanted to go there the first time. I've heard about this place, exactly to be one-on-one with nature. You can find very few places like this in the modern civilized world.
What was your reaction when you heard about the Kakhovka Dam? Did you immediately think about this place?
Так, звісно, це дуже велика трагедія, тому що не тільки Олешківські піски,
а I thought about Olashky Sands, but I also thought about all the other nature that will suffer, that will be endangered and that will be put in jeopardy as a result of this terrible tragedy.
Це чути, боляче чути про те, що відбувається.
The war overall is a terrible tragedy because people are being killed, infrastructure is being destroyed.
Гине природа і так далі.
But when it affects sites that are close and dear to you, it's very painful because you have some sort of connection to these places. You love these places. You want to go back to these places. And you understand that possibly you might not be able to go there anymore. And I wish this war is over as soon as possible and we can go back to traveling to our beautiful country and exploring it again.
Ukrainian trail runner Andrei Filin there, speaking through interpreter Volodymyr Solohub. Since the war began, Olashka Sands has been off limits to most Ukrainians. That's because it's in Russian-occupied territory. Satellite images show that parts of the desert were flooded by the Kakhovka Dam burst. A Ukrainian conservation group says much of the rest of the park is likely waterlogged, putting the normally arid ecosystem at risk. Park staff are not being allowed in to assess the situation, so it remains unclear how extensive the damage has been. You're with the world. When the Taliban retook control of Afghanistan, some university students got visas for Kyrgyzstan. It was supposed to be a stopover before heading to America.
Some of us have done 2 master's degrees, and we will be stuck and forced to stay for a 3rd master's degree.
Plus, the trick to getting a meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping, ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Top secret leaks of classified documents. It's a theme that runs through the news regularly. A half a century ago, that wasn't the case. It was a radical transgression when Daniel Ellsberg leaked a top secret history of the Vietnam War that became known as the Pentagon Papers.
In all the writing I was reading, I could be skeptical of this, I could be worried about this or that, but I had never read anything authoritative that was that prescient, you know, and that pessimistic about what we were going to do.
Ellsberg died today at his home in California at the age of 92. The Pentagon Papers exposed the truth of how several presidential administrations misled Americans about the war in Vietnam, and it prompted a Supreme Court case on press freedoms. Ellsberg was a Pentagon insider turned whistleblower. His story was told in a 2021 documentary series by reporter Charlie Sennett for GBH's Ground Truth Project.
Ellsberg spent 7 days a week at the Pentagon, burying himself in work. With short notice, Ellsberg signed up to go to Vietnam to join a State Department working group to evaluate the war and the effectiveness of Commander General William Westmoreland.
I went to Vietnam sharing the widespread belief that we were being lied to in the Pentagon, as we were to a large extent.
Ellsberg wanted to see things with his own eyes. He wanted what we call ground truth, a phrase that's often used in a military context, and a process he learned from his father, a structural engineer.
Go out into the field and see what they're actually doing on the basis of your blueprints. You've told them exactly what screws to do and what order to do things in your blueprints, which I saw in his office. He said, but you never know what they're actually doing to implement those. It's inconvenient. They don't have the right kind of lumber. They do something else. And they're not doing it in hopes that the building will fall down. They're doing what they think is the best they can do under the circumstances. And it may be terrifically different from what you know is necessary.
In Vietnam, he would risk the dangers of the front lines. He landed in Saigon in August, the wave of heat hitting him, and the buildup immediately evident, even on the tarmac. Soon he'd be setting out to the jungle to see with his own eyes how the war was waged, what the Pentagon's distant calculations looked like on the ground. But first he wanted to see the perspectives of those outside the Pentagon's bubble.
These were people, most of whom spoke fluent Vietnamese. They knew the countryside, they knew the peasants, and they knew how corrupt the Saigon regime was. And there was no American who was more knowledgeable about the war than my friend John Paul Van.
Van was a retired lieutenant colonel who had fought in Vietnam a few years earlier, but was now a civilian advisor for the U.S. government.
I started out driving with him. In the end, we drove thousands of miles together on roads that no one else was willing to drive. I learned that from him. So we had shared a lot of danger together, and I just was very close to him.
Ellsberg and Van traveled some of the most dangerous routes across the South, with one hand on the wheel and the other bracing an AR-15 rifle out the window. Van would fly down provincial roads as fast as 70 miles per hour. Arriving at a distant outpost, Van and Ellsberg had instant credibility for driving on roads which had long been ceded to the Viet Cong. Eventually, Ellsberg visited 38 of the 44 provinces, sometimes with Van, sometimes alone, but he reached the same conclusion wherever he went.
There was no prospect of a win here. We could stalemate as long as we wanted to go on killing and being killed. More troops would not make any difference. If anything, it would make it worse.
Ellsberg confirmed what he already suspected, that the reports sent to the Pentagon did not tell the full story. He soon learned that the military's brutal tactics were killing civilians, and those who were not killed were driven to support the Viet Cong.
We thought of ourselves as offering independence from North Vietnam. That didn't correspond to the thinking of any Vietnamese. Neither regarded the other as a foreign country. On the other hand, to see us as invaders, as the North Point, was pretty obvious. There were those people who preferred American domination to communist domination. Okay, and we saw that and we thought, that's realistic. We are better than those guys. And we couldn't ever understand why the rest of the country didn't seem to see it that way. Why wouldn't they rather have us? Well, for one thing, we were bombing the shit out of them, north and south. And the idea that we were gaining hearts and minds while bombing them was absurd. It was a self-deception, a delusion.
These realizations were summarized in the working group's report, which they submitted to General Westmoreland. It was a full year's worth of gathering data, interviews with civilians, and on-the-ground observations.
The report recommended the end to all unobserved artillery in Vietnam, which meant with no observer who was seeing a military target to aim at. Nearly all the artillery was sent where civilians would be, unobserved, just on a regular basis. And all the aircraft raids in South Vietnam. Most people were killed in the South. More bombing was done in the South. And most of it, again, was really against jungles where they didn't have a real target. End all of that and just have air in support of people who were engaged in combat.
The report fell on deaf ears, something Ellsberg would get used to.
Of course, none of our recommendations were actually followed, none of them. Westmoreland, he wasn't going to do anything about the air, etc. But what we were trying to do was greatly to lower the violence in Vietnam.
Soon after, Ellsberg bottomed out.
I had come around to a point where I didn't feel I could accomplish anything
in Vietnam, and therefore there was no need for me to stay there.
Merry Christmas, my sweet darlings. Kids, I didn't get you any presents now because Saigon has sort of run out of things that I think would really interest you, just like the old airport toy shop finally was exhausted. But when I get back, you'll be repaid.
It was Christmas, 1966. Ellsberg's despair would once again become recklessness.
I joined the deputy ambassador as an assistant last week, and that gave me the excuse immediately to go out in the field and live with some battalions in the field. Tomorrow, I'm hoping to go out to the same area and stay with several other battalions of the same regiment for about a week.
Just days later, Ellsberg was patrolling with one of those battalions in what was supposed to have been a pacified village south of Saigon in the Mekong Delta. It was New Year's Day, 1967.
I was walking at the point, four guys more or less in front, to attract fire, basically, that's their job. So you get fired at, and they know there's Viet Cong up there. We go through a rice field with rice fairly high, and all of a sudden we hear firing from behind us. So we look back, and it's clear that there's some people in that rice paddy we just walked through that are firing at the main body of the troops behind us. Well, the troops are all firing back. We can't fire at them, even if we saw them, because we'd be firing into our own troops. You know when a bullet is coming at you, it goes crack. It's a very sharp crack. If it's 3 feet away, it's different. It's a different sound. But my memory is you could hear those bullets over your head. There was a kind of a shh, shh. We get down, the fire's coming over our heads, and then I see kids that looked about 14 or 15 with AK-47s, bare-breasted, with shorts on. So they're going through the grass, getting out of the way, because they were, the Viet Cong in this area, guerrillas, generally would open burst of fire and then they'd get out before air power could come in. And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, they are in the middle of an infantry battalion here with air support? They must have been lying there while we go past them, maybe a foot or two away. They knew this terrain like their backyard because it was their backyard. And I think, these guys are not going to be beat. We are not going to defeat these people. We were, like the Redcoats, facing the militia, you know, in 1775, 76. We're on the wrong side here.
On these patrols, Ellsberg was sinking himself in the quagmire in some very literal ways in the rice paddies. His depression was descending into a death wish.
What I just did in Rock Ken was interesting. So I'll go in the field and I'll work my way down the coast, working with one unit after another till I get killed. It's an interesting way to go. It won't happen right away and it'll happen soon enough. And what interfered was that having spent a night on ambush in this rice paddy up to my waist, I came down with hepatitis, and that got me out of the field.
Ellsberg realized he could disarm the powerful. He could commit an act of dissent without bloodshed, without violence, without risking national security.
On September 30th, 1969, I said to myself, this is the system for which I worked for dozen years and more, in the Marines, in the State Department, in Vietnam, in the Defense Department, a system that lies from bottom to top, lies to conceal murder. And I won't be a part of this anymore. I said to myself, in my safe, I've got 7,000 pages of documents showing lies, deceptions, reckless decision-making, murderous, which amount to mass murder in the end. And murder is not something to be stopped just by turning away from it, not participating in it. It's to be exposed, resisted. You've got to do something about it. And I went to my friend Tony Russo and said, do you know where we can find a Xerox machine?
This moment was the culmination of 2 years of pivotal events in Ellsberg's life that turned him from a Cold War hawk to an anti-Vietnam War dove. He was ready to expose the lies of the war, to betray the trust he had been given as an insider in the Pentagon, and he was summoning the courage to face the severe consequences of doing so.
Charlie Sennett, reporting on Pentagon whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg for the 2021 documentary series The Whistleblower: Truth, Dissent, and the Legacy of Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg died today at age 92. When the Afghan government fell to the Taliban, hundreds of university students were evacuated to nearby Kyrgyzstan. Earlier this month, some of those students graduated. Levi Bridges reports from Bishkek that they have diplomas, but their future is unclear.
On graduation day at the American University of Central Asia in Bishkek, students in black gowns and square hats sit in the school's auditorium, waiting to be called on stage to collect their diplomas.
Congratulations, class of 2023. I wish you all the best.
Students graduating from the school, which is called AKA for short, receive U.S.-accredited degrees. After the ceremony, I meet 27-year-old Shams. Like other Afghan students I meet here, he didn't want to give his full name to protect his family back home. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a good day.
Back in Afghanistan, Shams worked for a development agency. He says doing that kind of work, you had to pay a tax to the Taliban, and he wasn't willing to do that.
These were things that the Taliban didn't really like, and that kind of put me in their blacklist.
Gunmen tried to shoot Shams and his colleagues while they were driving on a work trip, but they narrowly escaped. When the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, young people like Shams faced a clear risk. So an international group of volunteers evacuated them to Kyrgyzstan and helped them get student visas and scholarships to continue their education. Most have applied for a program that would allow them to enter the U.S. as refugees, but it's taking longer than expected.
Some of us have done 2 master's degrees, and we will be stuck and forced to stay for a 3rd master's degree. And most of us are worried that Trump might win the presidency back from Biden, and we won't have the chance to go there.
Some of the students will come to the U.S. as refugees soon, but nearly 150 are waiting for approval. It's frustrating.
I have a lot of hopes and aspirations for my personal life. For example, I want to get married. I want to have kids. These are things that I can't plan for right now.
But students are still really grateful to be here. At a cafe, I meet a 24-year-old Afghan woman who just graduated from AKA. She prefers not to give her name. She was in Kabul when the Taliban entered the capital.
And after hearing that, me and my sisters, we all started crying. And the only thoughts were in my mind that time was like, my dreams are all just gone. I'll be like a housewife.
The Taliban banned women from attending high school and college. She says she feels blessed to be here.
But still, I cannot fully enjoy the rights I have because my close ones, my Afghan women, they are suffering. So I have these mixed feelings. Sometimes joy, sometimes sadness, sometimes frustrated.
Along with AKA, a number of other universities are helping educate Afghans. But Jonathan Becker, the acting president of the school, says the U.S. especially could be doing more. Millions of Afghans still can't get an education. Becker says he and his partners have found scholarship money to pay for Afghan students' room and board, but some U.S. universities still refuse to host them.
There are many institutions which have a huge amount of resources which they could put towards supporting Afghan refugees, and they choose not to use these resources.
Afghan students in Bishkek are doing what they can to help people back home. They've raised money to start a school in Afghanistan and launch work training programs for women. 25-year-old Wasal, a graduate student in anthropology, started an organization that mentors Afghan students to help them get into universities abroad.
It is difficult now to return back home, but it is not difficult to make a meaningful contribution to the community by any means.
At a recent event on AKA's campus, Afghan music plays during a ceremony students held to thank the school for bringing them here.
In a nutshell, you not only save our lives, but also you give us hope.
The Afghan students here are part of a tight cohort at a small school where many students know each other. They're especially grateful to be a part of this community because the world's attention has shifted away from Afghanistan. The 24-year-old woman I met at the cafe says being Afghan today feels like you're invisible.
And you are the one that no one is talking with you. I'm feeling that way, that your presence, your existence, it doesn't matter to anyone in the whole place.
Students like this Afghan woman say they have a huge responsibility to use their education to help Afghanistan, because especially now, it feels like no one else will. For The World, Levi Bridges, Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping met with Microsoft founder and head of the Gates Foundation, Bill Gates, today in Beijing. Xi called Gates an old friend. Gates was also apparently pleased to see Xi.
Very honored to have this chance to meet. And we've always had great conversations, and we'll have a lot of important topics to discuss today.
Author Chunhan Wang is here to unpack what they discussed. He wrote Party of One, The Rise of Xi Jinping and China's Superpower Future, and he joins us from Singapore. First off, Chunhan, what's Bill Gates doing meeting with Xi Jinping right now?
So it's an interesting trip. He's obviously in China to follow up on his work at the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation. But we found out just before the meeting was going to happen that he's going to meet the Chinese leader Xi Jinping. And interestingly, this is not the first time they've met. They are known to have met in 2013, 2015, when Bill Gates went to China. And so there's sort of this existing rapport between them. And in fact, in 2020, when Bill Gates committed to donate money to help China fight the COVID pandemic, Xi Jinping wrote a letter back to him saying thank you. I think the interesting thing is why the Chinese decided to arrange this meeting and at this time, which is literally just before Secretary of State Antony Blinken is to visit China. And I think it's probably a signal to the Americans that we are interested in stabilizing relations with the U.S.
I want to turn to Bill Gates for a moment. What hat is he wearing on this visit? Philanthropist, business mogul, American diplomat, all of the above?
I think it's sort of all of the above. Bill Gates would have gone there, you know, wanting to do philanthropy. That's the hat he's officially wearing. But in terms of publicity, from the Chinese point of view, and the signaling, the sort of optics that the Chinese are going for is to show that, you know, Chinese still has friends in the United States. They have an ongoing relationship with preeminent people in American public life, and calling on these people to help promote better relations between the two countries. And they want to appeal to friendly faces who sort of, in their point of view, understand China and understand the importance of the relationship. And they're hoping that these people can help convey a more positive tone to interactions between the two governments.
What about Secretary of State Antony Blinken? Do you think that he sees the meeting between Xi Jinping and Bill Gates as sort of a good thing, a warm-up for his own meeting? Or do you think these two meetings are completely unrelated and they don't overlap at all?
I think there is a relationship between the two meetings in terms of what the Chinese are trying to do, in terms of what message they're trying to send. But we are not sure whether Blinken would definitely get a meeting with Xi. Obviously, it would be good if they met in terms of diplomatic point of view. And in fact, it would be quite telling if the Chinese chose to arrange a meeting between Bill Gates and Xi Jinping, and they don't do so for Blinken. It would be probably very likely seen as a snub, you know, by the Chinese to the U.S. So in terms of signaling, I think it would be a much more positive sign if Xi Jinping does meet with Blinken. We should not draw too much association between the specific content of these two meetings, but more that the overall context in terms of what the Chinese are trying to do by arranging such meetings.
I wonder, could Bill Gates' visit backfire at all for Washington? I mean, could Beijing use this visit and the photo ops to show that, you know, hey, your business leaders are reasonable. It's you, the government in Washington, that's unreasonable.
That is sort of a message that the Chinese have been trying to use from time to time. And, you know, the Chinese have reached out to other personalities, you know, American business leaders, preeminent figures in American policymaking circles. So this is something from the Chinese playbook to try to portray American politicians as the ones who are causing all these problems in the bilateral relationship, and that China is the benign party trying to reach out to the Americans, trying to reach out to friendly faces and trying to broker a more stable relationship. But that doesn't necessarily translate to other concrete actions that they take in engaging with the American government. I think we have to be aware of what is the public messaging, what is the publicity narrative that they're trying to put out versus concrete actions that the government is taking.
Chunhan Wang writes for The Wall Street Journal about China. He's the author of Party of One, The Rise of Xi Jinping and China's Superpower Future. He's been speaking to us from Singapore. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Herding cats, banging your head against a brick wall, shouting into the wind, all expressions of futility. But that last one, shouting into the wind, well, new science shows it's not as futile as you might think. The World's Anna Kusmer explains.
Koalas aren't actually bears. Marmalade is underrated. Waffles are better than pancakes.
Shouting into the wind. You're yelling with all your might, but you can barely hear yourself. The more forceful the wind in your face, the louder you feel the need to be to get your point across.
Birds deserve more respect.
But a new study says when you do it, you're actually louder than you think.
The yeller thinks that he is quieter, but the person who is in front might hear him very well.
Ville Polke studies acoustics at Aalto University in Finland and recently discovered why.
It took 8 years for me to understand this.
In the journal Scientific Reports, Polke was finally able to describe why shouting against the wind makes you feel quieter. It's related to an effect known as convective amplification. Put simply, when sound slows down, it sounds louder. And when it speeds up, it sounds quieter. When you yell into the wind, the air speeds the sound of your voice back into your ears, making you sound quieter to yourself. But to people upwind, you're actually being amplified.
That was actually one comment from the reviewers that he has been always wondering why the cyclists are yelling so much.
People on bicycles are yelling into the wind, which makes them feel the need to be louder. Illustrated to perfection by the TV show Portlandia.
Bicycle right!
Bicycle right!
Bicycle right!
Bicycle!
On a bike!
On a bike!
I'm on a bike.
You're gonna turn?
You gotta tell me!
Watch out! Bike, 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 bike!
To do this research, there's a special outfit. Polke wore an old-timey leather flight helmet with goggles.
I have it still. It's a bit dusty.
He stuck his head out of his car's moonroof, drove around, and shouted into a ring of microphones stuck to the top of his car, shouting continuously. I had to know. What does he shout?
Siili viilaa tuuba, tuuli puhuu Kiinaa.
It's nonsense. The hedgehog is filing its tuba, and the wind is speaking Chinese.
Some easily pronounceable words that are kind of easy to shout.
Polke says this research has some applications. It could help figure out the optimal place to put a siren on an ambulance or improve knowledge of noise pollution. Mostly, it helps advance fundamental questions of acoustic science.
I'm just happy that I could fill one hole in my world.
Filling a hole in science by shouting about hedgehogs? Nice work if you can get it. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening. From PRX.